This is a recording of an AA speaker, Cliff Roach, with Jerry W. as warm-up speaker, recorded at the St. Paul Speaker Meeting in Visalia, California, on March 17, 1990. Please observe the anonymity of all AA speakers. Thank you.
With a 10-minute speaker, most of us, his name is Jerry W., but we know him as Bubba. Would you like to come up here, man?
Hi, everybody. I'm Bubba. And I'm an alcoholic. I'm also Jerry Weatherford. But I like for my friends to call me Bubba. You know, that a friend gave me that name. So when you call me Bubba, it's not an insult. It's I appreciate it. So, well, talk a little bit, I guess, about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm grateful for what it's like now. When I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I just thought maybe I drank a little too much and couldn't control it at times, you know. And I thought an alcoholic was a person that was a skid row bum living in a park or something like that, you know, because God didn't take me that far in my alcoholism. And but today I know I could have gone that far and would have gone that far if I kept on drinking. But I'm grateful that I didn't have to go that far. And the professional people that tried to give me advice and help me throughout my drinking career, I couldn't relate to them, and they couldn't get through to me, this thick skull of mine. And I probably wasn't ready for help, didn't think I needed it, from what I know now. But I started drinking as a young teenager, like most of us do, or most of the stories that I've heard since I've been here. And I drank until I was 48 and a half years old. And I've been clean and sober now. Thursday was the 15th of this month, was 1 year and 6 months. Through the time I was drinking, I didn't have to go to a lot of jails and do some of the things that some of the people here have had to do. But when I got here, I was just as miserable, and I had reached my bottom, and I was just as sick as the people that have had to do some of those things that I didn't have to go, do. And I realized that, and I'm grateful for that today. Through my drinking career, I didn't hurt my friends and the people that I partied with. And, it was the people closest to me that I hurt. And, that being my family. And, I'm fortunate to still have my family today, to have my home, and to have my business. That small business here in town, and truly grateful for those things today. And I wouldn't know what I know today and understand what I understand today and feel what I feel today unless it was for this program. Because after 48 and a half years old getting my first DUI, I had to spend a few Sundays out at Bob Wiley's resort, you know, and I handled that all right. But then the courts also sent me to a program they call Alternative Services, I believe it was, and there was a little lady sitting across the desk asking me a lot of questions, you know, and giving me this 20 question thing, and I didn't pass that, by the way. And she told me that I was going to have to go to 12 of these A&A meetings, you know. And I wanted to reach across that desk and grab that little woman up and just slap the hell out of her, you know, because I didn't want any part of A&A. I didn't think that I was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to go down and sit with the Skid Row bums and the people with wet brains, you know. And that's exactly how I felt. I have to be honest with you today. And when I got here, I thought I was better than most people that were there. And, you know, I didn't fit. And I ended up going to my meetings. I chose the Alano Club over on Santa Fe because out at Bob Wiley's resort on the weekend, the jailhouse attorneys out there, they told me to go to the Alano Club because at that time they had three meetings a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and they were only an hour instead of an hour and a half, and you wouldn't have to put up with as much bullshit, you know. So I started going to the Alano Club to get these court cards or get well cards or whatever we call them around here. And that was why I was there. And something happened while I was there. You know, I started, at first I didn't pay attention. I was just there and I was getting a court card signed and getting the hell out of there and getting back to work, you know, and get all this stuff taken care of so I could get on and start partying again, you know. And but I started listening and I started relating, and you know, as a lot of you know, and I've told you before, my wife is in one of the other 12-step programs, you know. She's, and I started listening to what the people around the tables were saying, and then I knew for damn sure that this Al-Anon wife of mine had went over there and told you guys about me, and you were to bring this stuff up, you know, to me and let me know how bad it was. And I honestly thought that, you know. And anyway, I started listening more, and it started sinking through this thick, hard head of mine, you know, and I started relating a lot, and I knew that maybe this is a chance for me to do something for this, because from the time I was 30 years old to 48 and a half, I tried to quit drinking on my own for years, you know, and I was successful at times for a year at a time. I went 5 years at one time. The last time I quit drinking before I got here, I quit for 3.5 years. And I thought I had the bull by the horn, you know. And now I realize why I was so miserable when I quit drinking, you know, because I didn't know how to live inside me. And I was miserable all that time. You know, I used to yell at my family during those times, you know, when you're drying up, and they ran the water too loud in the faucets at home. You know, like that. And you know, it was. And but anyway, my last drinking run, and I used to go on quite a few runs. Sometimes I'd go for 3-4 days at a time, you know, and then I'd sober up enough and wake up. And I'd call home and I'd tell my wife, I said, honey, don't pay the ransom. You know, I've escaped. You know, and shit like that. Just crazy, you know. So. But it's sick, you know. But, you know, I started listening, and the message did get through to me. And I thought, this is a way that I just maybe I can get some help here, you know. And because I saw a lot of people around here that seemed to be pretty happy. And I wanted to be happy, but I had that fear of, you know, how can you be happy and not drink, you know, and have fun? Because when I was just dry, these times that I just dried up, I didn't have fun, you know. My family appreciated me, my relatives and my neighbors appreciated, you know, no scenes in the neighborhood and stuff like that. They appreciated that, and a few good things did come from just being dry. So just not drinking is better than drinking, you know, for me, the way I feel today. And anyway, I thought, well, maybe I'll try these steps and try this program, you know. And I started doing the steps. And I got to step 3. And Boy, I had a lot of problem with it. And I thought, well, I'm just going to skip over step three, and I can do this without a God, you know, or a higher power. I went on and tried to do the steps, and said that was worse than when I was just dry, you know. So I had to get a hold of a sponsor, and God, did I get a hold of a sponsor. Grass is my sponsor, and I went to him, and I asked him if he would be my sponsor, that I needed some help. And we talked, and I guess the guy could see right through me, and probably all of you could too, because he says, Bubba, we're going to start on step three. And we did step three. And we did step three. And we did step three. And, you know, today I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful to Grass for the help he gave me, because I do believe in God as my higher power. And he has been able to restore me to some kind of sanity. I'm not 100%. I still like to have fun, you know, and enjoy it, and a little bit crazy, but I'm grateful for that. And since then, I've been able to work through the steps of the program and apply the principles of this program in my life. And it's real easy to do here in the meeting. And when I'm around the group, you know, and the people in the fellowship, and I like to think I have a lot of friends here, because I like all of you, you know, most of you. I don't like all of you. I have to love all of you, you know. And sometimes that's not easy, but I work on that. And today. What it's like now is just, you know, I found a different way to live through this program. I haven't liked Bubba for a long time, you know, but today I like Bubba, you know, and I like Jerry. And I like the way I feel inside me, you know, and because today I have emotions, you know, and I feel for other people and other people's problems. And when you hurt, I hurt inside, and I could never do that before, you know. And I'm grateful for the other 12-step program, because my wife is getting a lot of help there to try to understand me, my sickness, you know. I had a lot of guilt for a while, because she had to be in that program because of me, you know. And I tried to hold on to that and try to own that. And I can't own that, you know. And I can't own other people and other people's feelings today and other people's problems. I have to own mine, and I have to do an inventory, you know, do a good 10-step pretty often, and find out what are my motives for doing what I'm doing in the situation I'm in now, and are they right, are they selfish, or am I just after personal gain here, or what will happen, you know. And I have to stop, and I have to really take a good inventory and meditate about it and think about it, you know. And I try to do that today, life isn't real easy. It's a lot better, but it's not real easy today. And but I'm a lot more comfortable with life situations that arise today. And I haven't been around that long, and I still do. My sponsor has given me something that's worked real well for me, as I wear the hell out of the 24-hour day book, you know. And I do that on the marble throne in the morning, you know, when I first get up. That's my place. And if my 24-hour day book isn't on the back of that, I get nervous, you know. But that's my time for me, you know, and people laugh at me, and boy, you take a lot of time in there, you know. And sometimes I take longer than other times, you know, when I'm bothered. But this I have to do, and I found I found a couple months ago in the 24-hour day book that something I could really relate to. I spend a lot of time fishing, not as much now as I used to, but I still love to fish and get up here on my boat on the lake and spend a day or 2 days or whatever. But in the 24-hour day book, it related to our lives and this recovery program as a lake, you know. For a lake to function, it has to have an inflow of water coming into it. And it has to have an outflow going out, you know, because otherwise if it was just there, it would become stagnant, you know, and stale and all that stuff. And that's why I have to keep coming to meetings and doing what I'm doing today in this program, because I hear things that I need to hear. And I can take those, and that's that inflow coming into my lake, you know. And then by sharing with others, or when others come to me and want to talk with me and share things with me, or I can help others and reach my hand out, that's the outflow. And if I connect, maybe things will keep working like they are for me today, because I'm really grateful to be a recovering alcoholic, and I'm grateful for all of you people, and thank you.
Comes all the way from Oceanside, California, down there close to San Diego, real close to San Onofre, where the nuke area is, probably affected him. He's got 20 years sobriety. Where the hell is Oceanside at? I think he'll tell us. This gentleman came to Tahoe this last fall, and he was sitting there completely exposed enough for us to take a vote. Us Farmersville group decided that since we couldn't have him in Farmersville, we'd like to have him in Visalia. He's got kind of Farmersville brand of sobriety from what we can see. He likes to have a good time. I'd like to give you Mr. Cliff R.
Hi, I'm Cliff Roach, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Cliff.
I'm delighted to be here. I think it's the only time, and probably will be the only time in my sober history, where they sent an airplane to pick me up to talk at a goddamn meeting, I'll tell you. Some goof fly down there and picked me up today, and we went to 9 airports and then finally got here. But I thought, I didn't know your name was Grass. I liked it when Bubba said, Grass helped me a lot. It helped me a lot, too. Well, it did me a lot of good. And I get off the plane and this nitwit and another one are standing holding some goddamn sign about the fan club. I mean, if I had ever asked God for a fan club, it sure as hell would have been in Farmersville. Chicago, maybe, or something. You know. Farmersville. And I know there's some newcomers here tonight, and God Almighty, you heard the traditions, and they said, you know, it's principles before personalities, and you got to know, even if you're a sick newcomer, you got to know that this is a joke. We would not want you to think that AA really had a fan club. Otherwise, I'd be drunk if I ever believed it for a goddamn minute. You know, but it's fun. You know, you ought to see my Al-Anon when they say, the fan club, she goes, he really needs that. Oh, God. So if you're new, just, you know, that's what the hell. It's just all in fun. I was, you know, happy birthday, Ed. He's passed 2 years, huh? Oh, I'd hate to see him when he came in, huh? You didn't look all that well tonight to me. Well, yeah. You know, anytime they call people Bubba, I expected this monster to come up. Bubba was talking, he looked like John the Baptist. He gave a hell of a talk. That was a good AA talk. I hope I do as well as he did. When I was a year and a half sober, I could say, I'm Cliff. They get them up earlier nowadays. They wouldn't let me talk in the car when I was new. I'd say, well, I think nobody cares what you think. You don't know nothing. Shut up. Well, they do that now. They let the newcomers come up here and make fools themselves. I thought our caper lady, there was a newcomer, the way the door slammed on her. But I'm delighted to be here in Visalia, the gateway to whatever, the Farmersville. And there's a lot of you. A lot of, you know. Now, most times you hear the speaker say, you know, you don't look like alcoholics. Oh, yes, you do. In Visalia, you look like alcoholics. And I know I'm home. I know I'm home already because we're laughing, huh? And I don't know. That's all I was ever trying to do myself when I was drinking. I don't know about you. I hear people say strange things from this podium, but I was with Bubba. I was just, of course, he didn't say it right. I'm not sure Bubba's a real alcoholic. Did you hear the way he said it like an Al-Anon, did he?
Fun? I was trying to have fun.
We had fun! I don't know about you, boy. I'd get it in me and I'd get out there, and that's what I live for. Just fun! I'd love to say that in an AA meeting. Like, just, you look around, all their eyes glaze over. They all go, yeah. And you don't know what I'm talking. One place in the world they know what you mean. Fun! Getting the shit beat out of you and going to jail. Fun! Finding your car at the bottom of a ravine in the morning, huh? Remember? With you in it. Fun! I almost died of fun. It's like that dog in the Call of the Wild. I just could not resist it. I had one of those days when the boss was out to get me and got me, and I owed $1 billion and the world fucked. And I was married to that witch. And I had all these dope fiend children and old grass would come by and say, come on, Cliff, let's go have some fun. Just about died of it, And when Bubba was talking, I almost died of that same picture that Bubba had in his head. When I was in college, right after World War II, this guy and I were cutting through the park in San Jose on our way to college, and as we went by this bench, there was this miserable flotsam of humanity lying on his bench, the filthiest thing I ever saw. And a big beard, and a mucus coming out of his nose, and he smelled. We almost threw up just looking at him, my buddy and I. We hustled through that park, we got to the other side of the park, and Richie said, I remember he used the word alcoholic. That guy was an alcoholic. So I knew what they looked like. And that picture in here almost killed me. I think I was 20 years old then, and not 3 weeks before that, I lost about 17, 18 hours. And it took me 6 months to find out all the things I did. I drove to Santa Cruz, I've been on that Highway 17, and in the middle of the evening, I was thrown out of this bar for some fancied insult I gave to the bartender. So this other guy and I, they tell us, you know, much of my life is hearsay, isn't yours? Most of my life, saying, oh, I did? Oh, God. They tell us that we went down to this yacht club where he had worked and stole his cannon and put it in the doorway of this bar and shot it off. Boy, they said that place cleared right out. And I was in jail for a few hours. I don't know why they thought they took. And I drove back, you know, and it was months before I found out all the things. But that guy on the bench was an alcoholic. And that's the picture I carried, in and out of AA all the times. But I just love to drink. You know, I love to dance, and I love to sing. Oh, they love me in the piano bars, huh? The bartender, I mean, the piano player didn't. Everybody else liked, you know. Right until I start dancing on the piano, and I love to fight. Oh, I love to fight. Unfortunately for me, I'm no good at it. Never stopped me, though. Well, I was raised in this Irish Catholic family. Oh, no shit, yes. You know, my wife is talking, or talked this afternoon at a little roundup over in Victorville, which is a lot like yeah. And her birthday today. She's 20 years in Al-Anon today. Isn't it interesting that it's St. Patrick's Day? What a cruel joke by God, huh? Because she was from this Protestant bunch. She didn't know nothing until she married me. She calls us the CIA, Catholic Irish Alcoholics. You know? What culture shock would us for her? You know, funerals, weddings, you know. But the men in my family were tough guys. I mean, you know, my dad was the one time the leading contender of the middleweight championship of the world. And his brother Jack was this huge guy. And he was tougher than my dad. And his hobby was cleaning out saloons. And he would just go wipe out a whole bar. And there I am, you know. When I start drinking, I was 4'11". And I weighed 89 pounds. And 12 pounds of that was pimples. You know. But I found that booze made the pimples go away. And made me bigger. And made me brave. And I always thought brave and tough were synonyms. No, that's the second step. That's insanity. See? That's insanity. See? Because about the time I'd get enough booze in me to be brave, see, I'd lose my muscle coordination. You can get hurt doing that, I'll guarantee you. Boy. I took beatings my whole life. Horrible beatings. I don't think I'd ever want to fight. But I was proud of those beatings. You know? That made me a real man. And one time, these other four guys and I went down from Bakersfield to Long Beach. We had some fun. And I woke up in this little flea bag hotel where we were staying, and I thought I was blind. See? I had bled face down on this pillow all night, and it dried. See, so when I come up, the goddamn pillow came with me. And I'm smothering in there, you know. So this other guy and I threw water on it. I almost drowned then. We threw water on it. Finally got it just kind of damp, you know. Just, you know, full of, there's a big mirror on this dresser. You know. I looked in the mirror. I said, put the pillow back. Oh, I look like Quasimodo. You know. I'll never forget the four guys with me. They said, you were great, Roach. They said, you got up 19 times. That's the kind of friends I had my whole life. I don't know about you. Those were my buddies. But, oh, God, I had a good time drinking. I don't ever want to try to fool a newcomer here, you know, because I had a lot of fun drinking. But, I had that other aspect of it, well, you know, where I had those blackouts. And I never had a good blackout. I don't know about you. I've looked around in AA now for years trying to find somebody that had good blackouts. I never woke up in the morning and found I'd helped the little sisters of the poor all night or something like that. Mother Teresa and I were administering to the poor. I woke up in jail a lot of times, and always beaten up, wrecked cars, lost friends. You know, little kids looking at me. with terror in their eyes, you know. I just thought that was part of drinking, and I always tried to avoid blackouts. It was never my intention. You know, I never got up in the morning and said, I think I have a blackout, and I'd get beaten to a pulp and go to jail. Never occurred. Going to have a couple, right? Just a couple. But I met this lady in college in San Jose, right after I saw that drunk now that I think. She was down on Skid Row looking for an alcoholic to abuse her. And we entered this 20-year suicide pact together. And we had a dual disease. We had alcoholism and Catholicism. Consequently, we had a kid every 9 months and 20 minutes. It seemed like me. It seemed like every time I come out of a blackout. Who in the hell is that? They're all right when they're little, like kittens, you know. But they grow up, and as the years went on, I got weirder and weirder and weirder, and she got weirder, and they got weirder and weirder, and we were just Looney Tune outfit, I'll tell you. We were crazy people. And after a few years, I got a job as a school teacher. You know, this is the kind of guy that bites bartenders in the face. Okay? Get the job as a school teacher. You know. Oh, yeah, they wore clip ties where I drank, so I couldn't get them over the bar. You know. And I attacked people with tire irons and things like that. What was that? Oh, it wasn't me. I really became paranoid about those blackouts then, you know, because you do the things I do in blackouts, why they call you up to Sacramento and say, could we have your teaching license back, please? And so I never gave up blackouts. I never escaped blackouts, but I cut way back on them. And I worried a lot about them. And I tried to prevent them, but I had them anyway, but not as many. I get a kick out in the club sometimes. I'll have this thing, and it'll, you know, the chart goes down, and it'll say, onset of blackouts. Second time I ever drank out of blackout. I don't know about you. And I cut back on it. But I want to tell you that, I'll surprise everybody in this room to know that my drinking progressed. And I became, of course, a daily drinker, and it was absolutely necessary for me to drink every day of my life because I had to sedate myself. That's all there is to it. I could not live through a 24-hour period without some relief. And that's just the facts, ma'am. I'm not making that up or not yet. You know, you could never explain that to somebody who doesn't understand it. I had to drink. Okay? Now, life went on, and I taught up here in Manteca. That's not, well, it's up this way. See how much I drank in Manteca? I don't remember where it is. But I taught 3 years there, and then we moved to Oceanside in 1961. And it's a beautiful little town down there, about 30 miles from San Diego. And life went on, and it's not a contradiction. I became a relatively successful school teacher. And life went on, and my drinking increased and increased and increased. And in 1965, I had a surfboard shop down on the beach there in Oceanside. Another teacher and I had gotten this idea in the summer. We said, hey, we'll get a surf shop, you know, we'll rent. I'm still a surfer. I had heart surgery in July, and I'm still a surfer. So I'm not well. You know, I'm the oldest one on the Pacific Coast, I think. You know. Oh, the kids down there love me. They think it's, you know, help Mr. Roach back in his board. That's it. They go home and tell their fathers, oh, Mr. Roach still surfs. Ah, drop dead, you know, these guys. All their fathers hate me, but I love it. I just adore surfing. But anyway, in 65, this guy and the mayor of the town donated us this little building right on the beach. Can you imagine, for two drunks, this little building, free, gave us the building. It had been vandalized and stuff. We had to fix it up. You know, we painted it and put the windows back in and got a refrigerator. And 4 or 5 months later, we got some surfboards. No big damn hurry there. That's how the drinking was going then, I'll tell you. And we had these two chaise lounge chairs. Oh, they were beautiful. And we became sunset connoisseurs, Woody and I. And we used to measure the sunset by martinis. Looks like about a 7 tonight, Woody. And some guy come down the beach and say, I'd like to rent a surfboard. Screw off, Charlie. We're watching the sunset now. Best one we ever had was a 15 martini sunset. Oh, it was glorious. Beautiful. Magenta. One of those. And the sun and Woody and I went right together. They found us in the morning with sunburned mouths. Remember that? I'm going to get that put on the 20 questions if it's the last thing I ever do. You ever had a sunburned mouth? No, get out of here. How about the old deal with the watch, huh? But, we did well with that surf shop. We made a lot of money. Not enough to quit teaching, of course. But, and then, of course, the winter set in, and we were out of customers. And I went down in February of 1965. I went down to the shop to fix a surfboard. And I was not a morning drinker in 1965. As far as I know, I never had a drink in the morning till that time. I still think I called myself a weekend drinker. We just start on Tuesday. And I was working on the surfboard, sanding it, and I had the resin there to fix it. And I'm going along there, and I got real thirsty and I opened the refrigerator to see if there was a Coke or something.
That's vodka for me. There's no place to put stuff here, grass.
Don't talk to what the hell was I talking about? Oh, yeah, I know. And I opened the refrigerator to see if there's a Coke or something in there. And my buddy Wood, took him 10 years to get here after me. He's not bright, Woody. But he'd been there the night before, and he'd left about this much vodka in a half pint. You know, a drink. And there was some orange juice in the refrigerator, and I thought, hey, you know, a screwdriver would be tasty. That's why there's only enough for one. And I drank it, and then, you know, I'm standing on the board there, and we got all these newcomers here tonight. I like to tell us when there's newcomers. I'm standing along there. And then pretty soon, my mind talked to me. Don't you envy schizophrenics? There's only two of them in there. That morning, my head said to me, come on, Cliff, what a filthy trick. Shame on you. Drinking up Woody's booze that way. Did you guys see a midget go by? Oh, long time since I've had a drink, but that's it. And anyway, my head said, you know, what a filthy trick that was. Then my head said, why don't you go up to the liquor store and get Woody a pint? And that afternoon, I went up and got him a fifth. And I ended up just drunk. You know what I mean? Bory-eyed, my dad used to call it. And I got resin all over me, and the shop of the board was screwed up forever. And I lurched home. I told my wife, I'm getting drunk when I don't even mean to. I got to do something about my drinking. Now, that's a pure motive, folks. That's a sincere desire. Only one I ever had, including this time. You know. And she had cut this little thing out of the paper about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you want a drink, don't know why she thought to do that. You. And next day I called AA. And old Stan came out and got me and started taking me to meetings there in the Oceanside Carlsbad area. And Bill lives in Carlsbad. Everybody said, where the hell is that? It's right next to Oceanside. Bill, where are you, Bill? I thought you went outside to hide. Bill's a pilot. And I'm always reading about a guy who has a heart attack when he's flying people somewhere, and then this wife has to fly. So I brought him in case the pilot had a heart attack. Oh, nobody's dumb here, I'll tell you. Bill is one of those, you know, Bill went to a treatment center and got sober, and he went to two AA meetings and thought, ooh. It was kind of like Bubba. Ooh. And then he went 5 years without a drink. And he didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and he didn't drink for 5 years. And his life just got wonderful. He lost his business. His wife was divorcing him. You know, everybody in the world hated him. So he shows up on my doorstep. You know, and that's what 5 years living without, you know, living without drinking. You know, since he joined AA, he's gotten worse. No, I mean, he's one of the most peaceful men I know. You know, it just shows you the difference between people who don't drink and people who have a program. All the difference in the world. He's not the same guy he was 2-3 years ago, whenever it was he came around. Anyway, I was going to get... Oh, yeah, I went to these meetings. Now, in Oceanside and Carlsbad at that time, they just had... There weren't very many meetings, and they were real small meetings, you know. 6 or 7 dopes sitting around a table, you know. And I didn't enjoy it. It was boring. And I really didn't want to quit drinking, I don't think, you know. So I really felt sorry for myself. And I would go to these and I would whine and snivel. I was one of your top whiners and snivelers, you know. After about 10 minutes, somebody in the meeting would point out that I was whining and sniveling. Well, they didn't know that I was sensitive, too. Oh, yeah, that's always been my problem, not alcoholism. Sensitivity, that's my problem. And so they would hurt my feelings. And so I would punish that meeting. I would never go back there again. And, of course, they didn't notice, but, hell, I've done that in sobriety, haven't you? Punish a meeting, go back a year later, and it's twice as many as when you left. Taking your hand out of a bucket of water is what it amounts to. And so after a very short period of time, I kind of ran out of meetings to punish. But there was a speaker meeting there in Oceanside, real small, about like 40, 50 people every week. And it was at 6:30 in the evening, which was handy. And I met in the school hall there. And so I would go to that meeting every week or so. Whether I needed it or not, I would skulk in the back. And I was one of those, you know, that waited until the meeting was... I'm glad I didn't do it on that side. Wait till the meeting was just, you know, they were just getting started, and I'd skulk in that back door and grab that loser chair, you know, the one right by the door. No offense. And then, you know, they always like, hold hands there, and they said, oh, man, what was that? You know, I was gone. Because I didn't want to hang around with riffraff, you know. And I remember they had this sign on the podium. I'll never forget it. It said, "We care." Oh. So I waited, oh, maybe 30 seconds after the meeting one night. Nobody threw their arms around me. So I knew you were phonies. And I went to meetings for like 2 months. And I didn't drink for 5. But those meetings were so dreary. Once in a while, I'd have a speaker that I'd really like, you know. Somebody was entertaining. Somebody had been in like 12 nut houses and 9 prisons. You know, strangled their mother with her own braids. You know, good stuff like that. You know, entertaining stories. And but only once in a while. Most of, to me, it sounded like everybody's name was Clem. And his wife's name was Martha. And they'd been out of their bib overalls about 1.5 hours. And their problem had been drinking. Huh? Their problem had been drinking. Old Clem and Martha had been good, decent, happy, worthwhile folk their whole lives. But they had drunk too much. And after they'd drunk too much for a little while, it started really interfering with their lives. So they had come here to the A&A. They always said it that way. The A&A. And they had put the plug. And they had returned to being good, decent, happy, sincere, worthwhile folk again. It sounded to me like they'd been rehabilitated. See, now, in 1965, my hero was a guy named Eldridge Cleaver. Yeah, he was a black militant terrorist. Well, that's my politics in 1965. Blow it up or burn it down. I didn't give a shit which. You know. I was for peace. No. If you weren't for peace, I'd kill you. And I'd gone down here to Elders, give this speech a couple months earlier down in San Diego. And boy, he was on that. You know, he used to use the 4-letter verb before it was popular in AA. Well, he used it as a noun, adjective, adverb, participle, gerund. He had all the uses. But anyway, that night, you know, he talked about this rehabilitation, about they're always trying to rehabilitate him in the prison system in California. And he says, you know what they'd never known? He had never been rehabilitated. See, you can't rehabilitate somebody who's never been rehabilitated. See, that's how I felt in AA. Evidently, Clem and Martha at some time in their life had been okay. See, I've never been okay. I don't know about you. I only have my story.
I've always been crazy. I was crazy long before I drank. I was nuts when I was 4 years old. And I have a little memory of myself when I was 4 years old. We lived on the Speedway in Venice, California. And I can see myself. I had this beautiful little shock of white hair. Oh, I was gorgeous. And the little short pants. My tricycle was sitting there. I can remember this. And I'm standing there. There weren't very many cars in those days. And I'd wait. And a car would come by. I'd go. And I'd wait for another. Didn't know how to do this yet, you know. That's how I felt when I was 4 years old. I don't know about you, but that's how I felt. And that's how I felt my whole life. I was always angry, and I was always afraid, and I always had a hole in my gut that the wind blew through, and I always wanted what you had. I didn't know what the hell that was. But I didn't want what I had. And I never wanted to be who I was, and where I was going. And that's the way I lived from the time I was 4 years old. And when I took a drink, after I drank about 40 minutes, I had about 8 minutes where everything was okay. Everything in my life for 8 minutes a day was fine. Thank you. Now, a lot of times right after that, it all went downhill. See, but I don't know what you had. But in my life, if I didn't have that 8 minutes, I would have died. You would have had to kill me, or I would have had to kill you. Or they had to take me away, put me in a room without doorknobs. That 8 minutes was the only thing in my life that made life worth living. They wanted me to give that up to hang around with Clem and Martha. Surely you jest! Come on! So I quit going to AA. It was a bore. Remember the show in Laugh In 65? Oh, God, I used to want to leap up in the middle of me and say, boring! Would that have been boring? If I could have had a drink, I would have done it, you know. But it just was so dreary, huh? So I quit going to the meetings. It was too much for me to take. And one night after 5 months, I was having pizza and spaghetti, and I thought, hell, a glass of wine with pizza and spaghetti couldn't do any harm. And so I had a glass of wine with dinner, and nothing happened. Nothing. And a couple weeks later, I was teaching this millionaire how to surf, and he invited me up to his millionaire condominium to have a millionaire drink with him. And cheap son of a bitch only gave me one, too. Perhaps that's how he became a millionaire. I don't know. And nothing happened, huh? I was up in Saratoga, and then a couple weeks after that, and this buddy of mine broke out this fifth Irish whiskey, and we got drunk. So then I was drunk for like 2 years. I have to slip. Yeah, these ponies at 2 days, and they're back again. Get out there and do a couple of years. It would help a lot of them, really, if they got back. And I would go to AA then from time to time when the heat was on. I don't know if any of you were like that, but I would go to AA when my back was against the wall. And I got 30 days one time, and one time I got 40 days. You know. My favorite time, one time I came in the afternoon about 4 o'clock, and old Don the barber and these other three guys, boy, they quadro-stepped me. You ever been quadro-stepping? Y'all, and oh, listen, I just levitated out of the building that day. Man, I was spiritual. And I went over to my buddy Big John's house and pounded on the door. Old John was worse than me, you know. He came to the door. I said, John, we're alcoholics, and we have to go to AA. Big John said, okay. So I led John to the meeting that night and became his sponsor. And the next day, we both got drunk. A couple of months after that, John went to jail one night. Some money. He threw his wife through the window or something like that. And you know, the deputy sheriffs never wait for you to get dressed. You know, he had a pair of pants on, no shirt, no shoes. You know, someone had thrown up on his chest. We never figured out that. And I got him out of jail, brought his shirt and shoes down. We're coming back down the road, going back to Oceanside. And we're coming down right by the Torrey Pines Golf Course there on the old road. And I gave one of the greatest talks I ever gave about alcoholism. I explained alcoholism to John. I said, that's what your problem is, John. Blah, 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 blah. And I was beautiful. I wish I had taped it. I could have played it for you tonight. And old John just got tears in his eyes. And he reached over and patted me in the back of the neck. He said, boy, he says, good to have a friend like you, Cliff. Somebody will tell you like it is. It's okay, John. He says, why don't you pull a George's here? We'll have a drink. I said, okay. Call his wife a couple hours later. That's okay. I got him. I don't know. Bubba and I share a real common thing here. You know, I think probably Bubba was like I was. I was a functioning alcoholic. I think that's why I almost died of it. My sponsor came out from under the steps of the Seaside Hotel 7 years before I did. That's where he lived, under the steps of the Seaside Hotel. He was a Skid Row derelict wino, you know. He could drink or he could work. If he drank, he did nothing else but drink. That's the kind of drunk he was. He had a picture in his office that I always loved. The Planning Commission of Oceanside many, many years ago would talk about redevelopment, and they had pictures of the blighted downtown area, and they had a picture of my sponsor hanging on to this parking meter. Evidently, he had mistaken it for a restroom, see? And he's got this Hawaiian shirt that's about 11 years old, hadn't been washed, and rope holding up his pants, you know, and these shower sandals on, and he is the most, he looked like the guy on the bench, you know? And he had that in his office, you know? And my sponsor about 8 or 9 years ago was the chairman of the Planning Commission in Oceanside. So, you know, the Planning Commission had taken the picture of him before. But anyway, that's the kind of drunk he was. I can do it, see? I can keep it together all day. Well, one guy said a functioning alcoholic is one whose life works. I like that one, too. I like that. But, you know, I'm a working fool. I mean, I have to do 30 times more than you to prove I'm half as good. I don't know if anybody identifies with that. I mean, I do the job. You know, if the teacher next door quit for a few minutes, I'd go and teach his class. I mean, I'm a working fool. I just got to get out there and prove myself all the time, because I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, anybody who gets this much done. And my old man told me that lie. You know, my folks were both drunks. I'm the adult child of alcoholics. Okay, everybody's the adult child of somebody. Got a guy at home who's the adult child of Baptists. Ooh. Yeah. You can't even make love standing up. They say, you're dancing. Sucker, sucker. I was telling Graf a while back, you know, pretty soon we'll have the adult children of Amway dealers. You know? But my old man told me that if you eat breakfast and go to work, you're not an alcoholic. It made sense to me. You know? He never said a word about puking breakfast back up again. You know? So I ate breakfast every morning. And I work like a dog. There's a story that I tell, and I know that half the people in the room's lips are going to move with this story. I've never had so many people come up to me and tell me my story as tonight. So I think I could, if I just cork over here, somebody come up, I'll finish it. That's all right, what the hell. I know Grass could. He couldn't do it as well, but anyway, probably do it better. Anyway, among other things I was teaching at the time, I was teaching speech. That'll blow you away, won't it? He teaches what? The principal in Oceanside there called me in one day and said, hey, Cliff, he said, I got this flyer in the mail. They're about a debate and a speech tournament down at San Diego State College. He said, you know all that debate stuff. I bet you your students get a lot out of that. Why don't you go down there? And I said, okay. And I didn't know much about it. My background had all been in the theater. So I read a book and coached them. It took about an hour and a half to teach them all I knew. And we went down to this speech tournament 30 miles away down at San Diego State. We were amazed when we got there. These speech tournaments are big deals. I don't know if any of you have ever seen those. There are like 50 schools participating, like 500 contestants, all in three-piece suits and ties. We were Levi's. What the hell we know? And we got butchered. I mean, we didn't win a round. I mean, they annihilated us. I don't know what kind of drunk you are, but I don't like to lose. Ticks me off. So I'm steamed anyway, and I go to coach's room, and there's about 20, 25 of them in this room, and they're all pals. You know, they're all old-time buddies, and they snubbed me, it seemed to me. So I hung around all day. You know how we are. That way you could snub me longer that way, you know. One guy there really ticked me off. He had a lot of hair. That bothered me right away. Oh, I mean, you know, like one of those gray manes, not a hair, just gorgeous hair, you know, and about a $700 suit on. He was, the other coaches did this when they went in front of him. And this jerk, about 2 p.m, he suddenly whirls on me and says, "Where are you from?" God, I was grateful to be spoken to. I said, "Oceanside." He said, "Oh, where's that?" 30 miles up the road. I don't know what you're like, but he gave me a resentment. You know, I don't mean a resentment. I mean a resentment. It's one of those kinds. I don't think a day went by the next 4 or 5 years I didn't think about that guy. And I went back to that high school. I went through the IQ files. I found the 50 smartest kids in the school. I just stopped the kid in the hall and said, "You're a debater." Listen, I don't want to debate. I didn't ask for that. Get your butt in the room. Boy, they went. And the other teachers come home at 4, 4:30 I'm there every night. I'm there till 10 o'clock every night. And I mean, I'm working. I'm screaming and yelling. And about two kids every half hour. And I'm cursing and bullshit. Some reporter one time asked one of my students, "What's the secret of your coach's success?" The kid said, "Terror." He wasn't lying. You got any idea how much work that is, huh? You make 50 people do what they don't want to do. I mean, you got to get wind you up. I mean, that just nerves hang out the ends of your fingers about this far. You know, your brain gets too big for your goddamn head. You have to drink when you do that. And lucky for me, out in the glove compartment of the car, is a half a pint of vodka. Whatever Thrifty had in the basket that week. You know, seal unbroken. I never touched it all day. It would just lie there and getting warm, remember? Calling to me, "Go get him, Cliff, baby. I'm waiting, darling." You know, and I'd finish with that last kid in the evening, and I'd get in that car, and I'd smoke those big cigars, and I'd light one of those two-bit cigars, and I'd open that greasy vodka, huh? And I'd just say, I always drank half of it, the first shot. Yeah. And that vodka just slide down there, huh? Clancy says, "Go boom." I don't know what you're like, but that's the greatest feeling the world has ever known to me. I mean, if you got every psychiatrist in the world, end to end, they couldn't do me one jillionth the good of a half a pint of cheap vodka. Oh, I just nurse back up in my fingers, and my brain would subside, my muscles would relax, and if peace would steal over me, I'd puff that cigar. God damn, you're a good coach. And then I'd get rid of the bottle, huh? Always hid it under some trash. I guess they thought they were going to fingerprint it or something. I don't know. Then I'd sit there in that old Chevy of mine, old surfing wagon, huh? And I'd finish that cigar and let that magic booze do its work, huh? And just before I'd reach over to turn that key, I'd think about that gray-haired son of a bitch. Always gave him a few minutes. And then I'd go home and get drunk. And I got drunk at home just about every night the last 5 or 6 years of my drinking. And I'm a real violent drunk and a cruel, sarcastic, mean drunk. And I got drunk every night at home. And I turned that house into an insane asylum. Three of my kids in the late 60s now, we're talking, huh? Three of my kids are in high school now. My oldest son is working his way through high school as a hashish salesman. Has hair down to his butt, you know, and his head goes like this long. Call his mother man. "Hey, man, what's for dinner?" He took LSD like his popcorn. Oh, he loved LSD. I saw a few eyes around here tonight reminding me of it. must be the San Joaquin Valley sun. And, you know, they see lights all the time, those guys. Scare the hell out of you. You'd be right in the middle of a sentence. You'd say, what was that? Because I'd say, I don't know. What was? I didn't know. Oh, my drunken mother-in-law lived with us. She said, I'll explain it. And, and my wife, you know, in the terminal stages of pre-Al-Anonism, you know, she just, yeah, one of those ticks with the eye, you know, like that. Couldn't let her go downtown to Marinetown, you know. And she lost her sense of humor a long time ago. And those kids hated me. They just hated me. I didn't want too crazy about them either. Bunch of dope fiends. And, I mean, you know, the daughters had these boyfriends look like my son. You know, the three of them get on the couch together. You should have watched that. Jack Parr said one time, it's like they kicked the world and everything loose rolled to Southern California. I was in Omaha a few weeks ago, and a few of them hung on the bushes there, I'll guarantee you. I'll guarantee you that. I always said they tipped Southern California, everything loose rolled to my house, you know. Because, you know, I don't know what your drunken house was like, but everybody came to my house. Every kid that ran away, every dope fiend kid would move in with us, you know. Or my buddies would leave their wife again. They were in the, you know, there were just people around. It was just a madhouse all the time. I thought that's how everybody lived. I didn't care. I just whacked anybody came near me, you know. But I knew that if I can unload that witch and those dope fiend children, I'd be all right. I could drink like a gentleman again. And by God, I built that speech team. And a couple of years after that, my team won one of those speech tournaments. But I said anything to the gray-haired guy. It wasn't time yet. We know when it's time, don't we? And the next year, I think there were 12 or 13 tournaments, one of the two. My team won all of them. But I can wait. I think revenge is better than Christmas, don't you? Then the next year, there was a tournament. There were 25 schools competing in this tournament. My team scored more points, sweepstakes points is the way they measure those things, more points than the other 24 schools combined. Then I went up to the gray-haired guy, and I put my nose right against his, and I said, do you know where Oceanside is now? He is a blank. He said, what are you talking about? I said, don't you remember about 4 or 5 years ago, you said to me, Oceanside, where's that? And he said, we just moved here from Nebraska. I didn't know where it was. There's one drank like me. I love to watch. There's always somebody goes, yeah, I remember. Yeah. 4 years, this guy's been in his bed every night. I'm up in Oceanside. I'll get you out, Simon! He didn't even know it. And that's how I lived, you know. That's how I lived. And if you live like that, you have to drink like that. If I drink like that, I have to live like that. And I thought that was the only alternative I had. I didn't know there was any other way for a person like me to live. You know, and I've been in and out of AA for 5 years, and I had the foggiest idea there was any other possibility for a person like me to be able to live. And right after that, my wife and I had one of our main events, which the neighbors have come to miss so much. And I threatened to move out again. I was a great threatener of moving out, you know, and everybody said, yeah, Dad, go for it, baby, run! And I moved down at the beach where I'd wanted to live anyway. And I'd gotten rid of that woman and those children, and it was worse. I was drunk all the time. And I was missing work, which I had never done, and my life was going down the tubes, and I couldn't understand it. And I went by the house one afternoon, and I was haranguing my wife about money, and the hashish salesman was kind of bobbing in the background there. And I did something really stupid. Now that I look back on it, I turned to Dave and I said, Dave, what's it like not to have your old man around the house? And old Dave looked me right in the eye. He said, it's beautiful.
And I told you, sensitivity is my problem. He really hurt my feelings. And I went down to the beach and ran and raved and nibbled and whined. But I did not take a drink that afternoon. And I think that's significant, see. It's been a long time since I hadn't had a drink in the afternoon. And I went out and sat on the screen porch. And I sat there all that afternoon and into the evening. And I watched, I guess, the most beautiful sunset that I ever saw in my life. It was one of those, you know, where these... the ocean and the wet sand and the sky were all the same color, you know. And just about the time that the sun was setting down into the water, I just had what our big book talks about, that moment of clarity. I just saw me. I saw what David saw. I saw what I had become. Now, I told you that I hated myself my whole life. Bubba was talking about that earlier. I always despised myself. But I had had maybe... 2-3 things about myself all my life that I had had respect for. And I realized that evening as the sun was going into the water that I had traded in those 2 or 3 things about myself for the privilege of drinking salt. And I didn't like what was left. And I went in the bedroom and I dug through this old sea bag that I had and I dug out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd read it before and I traveled through AA and being an English teacher, I thought it was poorly written. It read a lot better this time. Nothing like death staring in your face to make you a good reader. And I read that book for 3 days and 3 nights. I read it cover to cover, all the stories. I read all, it was the second edition. I especially loved the story of the professor in the paradox, you know, another egotistical school teacher. And I got to meet him about 4 years ago. I'll tell you, you know, he's not dead and he's not drunk. They just took his story out of the book. He's pissed off too, I'll tell you. And sure annoyed him, I'll tell you. But I keep my second edition so I can read it. And on the third time through the book, I'd read it cover to cover, and on the third time through, I was on page 63 again. If you're new, on page 63, there is a prayer. And that prayer is step 3. And it was 3 o'clock in the morning on the 13th of January, 1970. And in my befuddled condition, it just seemed like it would be a good idea if I would kneel down on that filthy linoleum floor on that dump on the beach, and if I would just read that prayer out loud to myself. And that's what I did. I read, God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as You will. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And I had a spiritual awakening that morning. Just a quiet thing. I just knew I was going to be all right. I knew I was not in charge of my life anymore. I was in the hands of a power greater than I am. And I'm in the hands of that power tonight. I was in the hands of that power coming up on the airplane. And last July when I was going down that hallway to that open heart surgery, I was in the hands of that power that day too. I could not believe how peaceful I was going down that hall. They didn't even give me the good stuff yet. My buddy, the anesthesiologist, you know, an AA guy, he puts the needle, he says, this is a slip. But you know, you're going down that hallway watching the lights go by, there's nothing like that, I'll tell you. You know, when you get by the elevator, nobody will look at you. They don't want to see death, you know. And I could not believe the peace that I felt in me. You know, for staying sober with you clowns for 20 years, did that for me. You know, one of the greatest spiritual awakenings I ever had was 5 years into sobriety. We had a new principal. And he was a real snake in the weeds. But anyway, we didn't know that at first. But this guy, after about a month on the job, he calls me in. He said, I'd like to talk to you about something. He closes the door. He says, what are you up to? So that was a good gambit, you know. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. He says, well, I've been going through your records. He says, there's nothing in your file that doesn't say you're not a good teacher. He says, but your file also says that the girls in the office are terrified of you, that you intimidate other teachers, you know, that you're a vicious person. He says, I've been all over this high school for 3 weeks now, and I can't find anyone who doesn't like you. You know what I did? This is what I'm doing now. I started crying, you know. I just grabbed that guy. I said, thank you. He didn't come near me for 2 years. Well, he'd see me in the hall. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does to people like me.
It changes us and we don't even know it. You know, the only time I know I'm changing is, you know, like Bill does something right twice a year. And, you know, I'll say, hey, Bill, that's terrific. I'm really proud of you. You don't do that anymore. You know, Bill walks away and say, hey. And then as Bill walks away, I'll think, hey, I don't do that anymore either. That's a spiritual awakening. And I've had thousands and thousands and thousands of those. It's only hanging around with you that I can see what's happened to me. You know, if you're new here tonight, they'll tell you hear a bell. Oh, I just said that for the newcomers because I knew they'd be worried. Is it like Jack, when the big bug flies at him in the meeting, and his sponsor stands here and his sponsor says, yes, Jack, there really was a bug. But you know, when you're new, they'll tell you that you're very important to us. You know, that you're the most important person in the room. Right, right, right. You know, and it sounds like it's funny, but that's, you know, outside of Amway, nobody needs newcomers like we do, you know. I mean, I would forget, you know, I'm sort of like 20, over 20 years, that's ridiculous. And I, you know, I get up in the morning a lot of times now and think, oh, sure, I'm sober. You know, I get like God owes it to me. I'm supposed to be dead. I'm supposed to be in a hospital with a wet brain. You know, I'm supposed to be in prison because I killed you. And I'm walking around loose in the world. And it's all because of the power I found here. You know, I'm a good 12-stepper. Or I go to a dirty, filthy apartment and, you know, find some dirty, filthy guy. You know what I do when I get on a 12-step? The first thing I do, I get there, I look right down and look in the guy's eyes. You know what I see? I see what my eyes look like when I was 4 years old. Lack of power was my dilemma. And I get that guy cleaned up and get into a meeting, go to a coffee shop after the meeting. A lot of times, that night, sitting across the table from him, the power is in his eyes. And I know guys sober 19 years, 18, 17, 10, nah, you name it, 3 months. And I got to watch the power come in their eyes. I got to watch the lights go on. And I got to watch them change their life and become successful and happy and loving people. And I got to watch that, how many thousands of times have I got to see it happen, see? So when we tell you newcomers, we need you. We need you. We got to watch it happen to you. Otherwise, I'll forget what happened to me. Because that power came into my life that morning, and that power has never left me. I've tried to let go a couple times before I say, hey, so that night I went over, I'm trying to avoid talking about my sponsor tonight. He died in December. And I was hoping he'd be able to give me my 20-year cake in January, but he didn't make it. He had a few smokers, and he had emphysema. And he was the most loving human being the world has ever known. But he loved me so much that he never listened to any of my BS, you know. He took this pompous, egotistical, over-educated beyond his intelligence school teacher, you know. He called me the dummy school teacher. It was all one word. Except when he was mad, and it was a goddamn dummy school teacher. You know? But I knocked on his door that night, the 13th of January, 1970, and he wasn't home. And Margie, his wife, opened the door, and, you know, I'm on the porch there, and I'm a five-year loser, huh? In and out of AA for 5 years, obnoxious, opinionated jerk. There she opens the door, here I am. You know, big L on the forehead, loser. And she saw me, and that lady just came, just glowed. She just, come in. She's, oh, come in. In the house, I go, pour me a cup of coffee. This is wonderful. She said, Bill's been crazy lately. I don't know what, he's been going nuts. He's had nobody to work with. This is so nice. You know, Bill comes home about 10 minutes later and says, Cliff, oh, God, damn. In about a half an hour, I'm thinking, anything else I can do to help you folks out? Be glad to help you any way I can. Cliff's here. We can start AA now. Oh, but that's the way they made me feel, huh? I've been to 1,000 meetings where they say, what do you mean this is a selfish program? Nobody ever had to tell me that. I found out the night I got here. I knew they were glad for me, but I knew they were glad for themselves. Because they know the great secret. You know, you can't have this thing unless you give it away. Bob was talking about it. You see, me, all my life, I knew what was wrong with me. I was not loved enough. And that's true. I was not loved enough. Now my parents tried, my God knows my Al-Anon tried, my children, my students tried. See, what I never knew about me was, there ain't enough. You can't love me. I'm the black hole of lovedom. I mean, you got everybody in the world, all the people in China, everywhere said, let's love Cliff. I said, is that it? Is that all? And there isn't enough. But what I never knew was that I never loved enough. See, I never loved at all. I didn't know how to love. I had to learn to love newcomers before I could learn to love my own children. Now, that's sick. But that's the way it went. But the fact remains, I did learn to love newcomers, and I did learn to love my own children. Bubba was talking about, you got to give it away. See, that's the secret of love. The more love you give away, the more you have. That never occurred to me before I came here. It never occurred to me to give a goddamn about anybody else's life. You know, I sponsor all these goofs, and I love them, and I care about them, and I try to give to them, and I keep feeling better and better and better and better. My sponsor took me everywhere for 2 years. He took me to a meeting every night for 2 years. You know, and I took until it was time for me to give. I don't know if any of you know little Peggy M. from Nebraska. She's just one of my favorite people. She and I were somewhere, I don't know, about a year or so ago, and she was talking, and she said something. She said, alcoholism is the only prison where the locks are on the inside. And I just about fell out of the chair. But that was absolutely true in my case. You know, before I was 4 years old, I locked myself in there. I guess I thought I was keeping you out. And I don't know why. I'm not interested in psychological reasons. I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on psychiatrists so I could lie to them. I am too sick for psychiatry. I have to have a spiritual answer in order to live in the world. And AA has given me 12 keys to let myself out of that prison that I locked myself in. And my sponsor says, since I was an intellectual, they numbered them. 1, 2, 3. And I have let myself out. God and I have let me out. And, you know, insofar as that I share my life with you, I don't have to ever drink again. But insofar as I let you share your life with me, then I live happy, joyous, and free. That's what this program was designed for. So that people like me can walk around loose in the world in this skin comfortably. And sometimes, if you're new, you can plug your ears if you want to. Sometimes I live for like weeks at a time, joyfully. Oh, come on. A sick nut like me. I always thought serenity was something real, you know, sexual or something. I don't know. Serenity is walking around in your own skin comfortably. That's what serenity is to me now. Those kids turned out fine. I better wind this up pretty soon. Those kids turned out great, you know. My wife went to Al-Anon and learned to relieve. She even got the smile down. I'm releasing you. I always said the Mona Lisa was an Al-Anon. You know, they never took a vote on that with me. I don't like being released. I don't care for it. Oh, you'd ask me to make a list of my 5,000 favorite things. Released would not be on the goddamn list. But, you know, now when I got sober and she went to Al-Anon, these kids went berserk. You know, I mean, they're everything, you know. They're out the window. It's insanity. I'm living in insanity. And she keeps getting weller and weller, and I keep getting crazier and crazier, you know. I'm trying to help them for 2 years. I'll help you. Finally, one day, you know, she got through to me, and I went in the bedroom, closed the door, and I knelt down. You know, and I quietly said, you want the kid? Take the kid! You got him! And he did fine with him. in January, my middle daughter, Jan, gave me my 20-year cake, and I gave her her 2-year cake. And last Sunday, my youngest son, Chris, got his 2-year cake, huh? Didn't say that in that AA video, but he goes, try it at the Kiwanis Club, see how it goes over there. Yeah. My kids went to AA. Oh, Now, the hashish salesman, he's still having fun. On my 4th AA birthday, he said the big key. He said, my dad has shown me how to live. And that's the nicest thing anybody ever said about me on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's all I'll ever be. I'm an example of the power in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an example of what can happen to the power that's in your eyes looking at me now, what it can do with one human being. And, you know, he straightened out his life to a great degree. He graduated magna cum laude from the university in the state, and he served 2 years in the Peace Corps. But he's a spiritual man, wants to pay the world back. Came back and got a master's degree. And last time I saw him, he put his arms around me. He's like 37 years old now. He held me to him and he kissed me on the cheek and he says, I love you, Dad. That's a long way from the kid who said it was beautiful not to have me around. He was an agriculture major. I don't ask him when he grows. None of my business. None of my business. He did his Peace Corps in Colombia. We got two down, one to go. Right? And then the other two girls fall in love with dope addicts. You know, they're Al-Anons to be. No, they're both in Al-Anon now, anyway. And, you know, we were all together last Christmas. And even more important than that, when I had that surgery in July and that week I was in the hospital, those kids never left me alone the whole week in the hospital. They weren't all there, there were two or one or two or whatever, with a lot of laughter and a lot of kidding. But, you know, I could lie in that bed and look in those eyes, and those kids cared about their dad. And you can't get here from there. Only through a program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Al-Anon. Because that's what we call it in our house. You know, I tease Al-Anons a lot, but I love Al-Anon. I adore mine. Yours, too, if you may have a chance. But we were so sick, it took both programs, see? We were 20 years drunk together and 20 years sober. And we're starting our third 20 years together, and I assume it'll be the best ever, God willing. I'm Cliff Roach, and I'm an alcoholic, and that means I can never drink again as long as I live. If I take one drink or anything that affects me from the neck up, I have to go back to being that animal I was 20 years ago, and I believe that. You know, it's been demonstrated for me many times, and I demonstrated it to myself before I stayed here. And when I was new, you know, I told my sponsor that I was sensitive. He said, no, you're immature. That's what you are. And, you know, I took a drink when I was 15, and I never grew up emotionally. And the more I drank, the less able to cope with life I became. And so it became an obsessive cycle. And the steps and the sponsor and the people of Alcoholics Anonymous have helped me mature to where I live in the world comfortably. When I say I'm Cliff Roach, I'm an alcoholic, I got a lot bigger meaning than the other two, see. If you're new, I am a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Best thing that ever happened to me in my whole life. I'm grateful for every drink I ever took, every bartender I ever bit, because it got me here, where I'm convinced the only thing in the world that can help me live happy, joyous, and free. And that's how I live today, because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to read these sociologists in my work. I love sociologists. They're weirder than us. They're not as weird as Al-Anons, but they're weird. Their favorite word is alienation. Oh, they love that word. They always italicize. They never just write it. You know, they always say, that's what's wrong with Western civilization. We're alienated from each other. And what they're trying to say is, they say there's no sense of community left in Western civilization. You know, there's no place where a person can fit and belong and be loved. And every time I read one of those clowns, I always think, why don't you drink a little more? You drink as much as I drank. You find a place where you fit and you belong, huh? I belong in this room. And you belong in this room. We belong together and we love each other because we have to.
Now, because we want to. I don't know if I did anybody any good, and I didn't fly up here to save anybody. I came up to say this. I don't know if there's anybody in this room that really needs me. But I want to tell you one thing for sure. I sure as hell need you.